Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I don't just do it all the time, but if I hit a point of comfort with people and my environment, I just start doing it sort of mindlessly. I'm chopping some onions. I'm chopping some onions. You know, and then people look over and they go, what the hell?
This week, our guest is Serious Eats culinary director, Daniel Gritzer. Daniel graduated from Columbia with a BA in anthropology, but he'd already talked his parents into letting him intern at the age of 13 at Chanterelle, the seminal contemporary French restaurant that launched the downtown dining scene in New York City. After graduation, he worked for a year in organic farms all over Europe, harvesting almonds and padron peppers in Spain, and shepherding sheep in France. We're going to talk about shepherding sheep. He then returned to New York to work in some of New York's top French, Italian, and American restaurants. He started his food writing career at Time Out New York before becoming the gastronaut columnist at Food & Wine. Then we stole him and his knives a few years ago. And when he's not whipping up insanely delicious dishes for Serious Eats, he blows off steam as an instructor of, how do I pronounce this?
Capoeira.
An Afro-Brazilian martial art. Welcome the handsome, dashing, idiosyncratic, and insanely talented Daniel Gritzer to Special Sauce.
Hey, thanks, Ed.
Before we start about life at the Gritzer family table, how the hell did you get your parents to let you work at a restaurant at the age of 13?
Yeah, actually, if I think back on it, I was 12, and I know that because the question was, did I want to have a bar mitzvah?
That's awesome.
And you know, a lot of my friends at that point had their bar mitzvahs. I was enticed by the loot that they scored at their shindigs, but my family, we were absolutely not religious, and the Jewish side was only on my mom's side anyway. Although I guess according to Judaism,
that's the key.
And you know, my mom, I can almost guarantee you that it was a leading question. You know, it was one of those, do you want to have a bar mitzvah or?
That's hilarious.
Or maybe we could take you for your 13th birthday to one of the best restaurants in the city. And I thought about it for a few minutes and thought about the cash I'd be giving up.
Right, those envelopes that you get, you pack into that pocket.
Can you imagine, like, the comics and candy and other things, and video games I could have bought with that? And then I thought about having to go to Hebrew school and the fact that I, like, definitely didn't believe in any of it. And I pretty quickly turned to her and said, let's go to that restaurant. And so for my 13th birthday, we went to Chanterelle, which was at its second home in Tribeca at that point, because they'd started in Soho.
Soho, right.
My parents took me out quite a bit growing up, you know, New York, sort of classic New York City kid. But to a place like that, I had not been. And so I don't even know that I fully appreciated Chanterelle's significance in dining in the city and the country. When I went, I just knew it was a great restaurant. And it just happened that my mom used to work with David Waltuck, who's the chef and owner. She used to work with his father, Murray. And Chanterelle was very much a family-oriented place, both literal family and the staff. They really cultivated that. And so when we were walking into the restaurant, there's Murray going in to visit David and Karen, who's David's wife.
Who ran the front of the house.
And there's my mom. She's, hey, Murray, look, this is my son. We're coming here for his 13th birthday. And he says, would you like to meet my son? And I already had a huge interest in food and cooking, but it was, you know, food and cooking from that age. So I'd do eggs on the weekends, stuff like that. And he took me in the kitchen, and I met David. And, you know, it's the most remarkable thing. It's just, to this day, I'm blown away by what he did, which is that he looked at a freshly minted 13-year-old in the eyes and said, you know, if you ever want to come back and hang out here, just give me a call. I'm here. It's the thought of it scared the living crap out of me.
Sure.
Because at that age, like, that's a very adult environment. And I was comfortable around adults, but that was still something that was intimidating.
Right.
But I also knew immediately that was something I couldn't turn down. So, you know, within a few weeks or a month or so, I called up David and went in the kitchen. And I remember the first time there, I just stood against the wall, so nervous, just observing everything, plastered against the wall, because, you know, it's a tight space, trying to leave room for everyone. The second time I went, the woman who was working in Garde Manger at the time took me and she said, okay, you're not standing against that wall this time. Took me downstairs. She'd got some chef's whites that barely fit me, and they put me to work. And so, yeah, that's how it went.
That's awesome. And so you continued to work there throughout high school off and on?
Off and on, yeah. It wasn't like I was going in every week, but every, you know, several months or whatever the time frame was, I'd call up and say, oh, can I come in? And they always said yes. And each time I went, they'd give me new tasks. And I mean, it's incredible for at that age to open the doors like that to someone. And it was absolutely a formative experience for me.
And did you fall in love with cooking at that point with what you saw and what you became a part of? Did you go, wow, I'm home?
I don't know if it felt like home exactly, because it was such an unfamiliar environment. A restaurant kitchen is really, I mean,
I don't mean home, like a place where you could belong.
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, again, it's hard because when you're that age, you know, young teenager, I mean, my mom had a mouth on her. I heard everything by the time I was probably five.
Your mom had a mouth.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they say about, that's what she said about you. I talked to her. That Dale had a mouth on her. I haven't heard that expression in so long. I love that expression.
Oh my God. You wouldn't even, one of the funniest stories was one day I came home from school and I was seven, enraged. I said, Mom, I thought you told me everything there was to know about sex. She said, well, I thought I did. I said, well, what's an orgy? So anyway, point being, I was pretty comfortable with the adult humor that is common in kitchens. But even still, that's not a familiar place to be for a 13-year-old. And also didn't, you know, but I stood there and I'd snicker and giggle at their jokes. And I did, in a sense, really enjoy that environment, the banter, the teamwork, the camaraderie, the ballet of it all. I mean, it just the execution, the way the plates would all come up at the same time, the timing among the various cooks, and then the front of house would come in and they'd sweep all these plates away at the same time. And I knew from having eaten there on my 13th birthday, all the plates would land on the table at the same, you know, it's just this really
yes.
choreographed thing that was pretty fantastic. And yeah, and then the food was just mind-blowingly amazing, and I got to taste all every little, you know, they would give me, oh, try this, try this, try that. And so, yeah, I had like little explosions going off in my head all the time of just this is the greatest thing ever. No, this is the greatest thing ever for me, yeah.
If your mother took you to Chanterelle, it means that she was hip enough to know and that she was interested in food, right? So was the Gritzer family table more sophisticated than your average middle-class New Yorker's family table?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I guess maybe it sounds snobby to say that.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, my mom was, I mean, I think it's fair to say she was a hedonist in all senses of the word, passionate about music, about food, you know, these sensory experiences. And so, you know, I was eating raw oysters from when I was very young. She taught me to pick up. She was from Maryland. I learned how to pick a crab apart when I was like, you know, in diapers.
It's a great image.
All the kids in elementary school went with their PB&Js and tuna fish sandwiches for lunch, which I often did. I wasn't that abnormal, but it wasn't uncommon that there might be a tongue sandwich on rye with mustard in my lunch bag.
That's awesome.
And my mom was a very experimental cook, which is funny because now I look back and it's hard to remember a lot of specific dinners because we definitely didn't have that, oh, you know, it's like tuna casserole on Monday night and Tuesday night is like chicken night and Wednesday night's pasta night. And not everyone did that, but you know what I mean. There's sort of like these standbys. We didn't really have that. I have no memory of almost any repeat things. I mean, sure, spaghetti with tomato sauce and meatballs and that kind of thing probably appeared somewhat with more frequency. Or
yeah, because like my mother only made like three things.
Yeah, no, it was changing all the time.
Wow. So you go to Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
You're a New York kid
mm-hmm.
with a pretty sophisticated palate. You've worked at a serious restaurant. Did you think cooking was going to be your career, or was it sort of in the back of your mind at that point?
Yeah, not at all did I think cooking would be my career. It was that it was one of those things I was obsessed with on the side as a hobby. I would obsessively read about cooking. I was in college. I started in 96, so this was sort of the dawn of the internet. But there were some. The New York Times had a series early on, a video cooking series that one of the chefs from FCI maybe led. And I studied every single thing he did in those videos.
You are kind of an obsessive.
Yeah, I have that streak.
I think that's what all the cooks at Serious Eats have in common. You, Stella, Kenji, you're all obsessive.
We're obsessive, yeah. Yep. That's fair to say. Yeah, but as a career, no. It was really, I started out at Columbia pre-med because I was really into science. I had done a Westinghouse project when I was in high school and interned in a biochemistry lab at Mount Sinai for a year and all this stuff. And then I had general chemistry and I decided I hated it so much, just the way the subject matter was presented. I ran away from it as quickly as I could. Ended up an anthropology major. I was deeply into music and anthropology studies.
Did you like gamelans?
I played in a Javanese gamelan.
Yes, gamelans are these. They were Javanese raves. That's how I describe them.
Yeah, they're these tuned kind of gong and tuned xylophone bell type Indonesian orchestras
that could go on all night.
They're fascinating. One of the greatest things about the gamelan, just from on a conceptual level, is that the most important instrument in it is the easiest one to play. I mean, it completely inverts all of Western expectations, maybe, about how these things should work. The big gong, which gets played generally once per cycle, and there's this sort of time cycle happening in a gamelan, like a hands on a clock, things sound at different times. That big gong, it just sounds at midnight once per cycle, that's the most important. If that doesn't happen, it all falls to pieces.
Right.
And I love that. I love that, like, the more proficient you become, the less important the thing is you're doing.
Yeah, that's really funny. So you majored in, what'd you say, anthropology?
Yeah, I ended up in anthropology. I thought I would go to graduate school and get a PhD in anthropology focused on music, sometimes called ethnomusicology.
Yes.
Got Fulbright to go to Zimbabwe and study Zimbabwean music there, and then it didn't happen at the last minute for unexplained reasons.
You mean they gave you the Fulbright and then took it away?
Well, they have this thing where this was a long time ago, but they award it, and you go out in the announcement, like, X number of people have been awarded the Fulbright, but then there's the specific arranging of where you're going to do your studies and stuff, and so...
That's
sometimes
along
it
the line.
Doesn't work Got on it. That side of things. So it didn't work for me on that side of things. And so I went to plan B, which was to go to Italy for a year and work on farms because that food interest was always the other thing that was running.
Right. That was always plan B.
Yeah. Still not to be a professional cook, but I would look at food writers, people like Jeffrey Steingarten, and I really liked Margaret Visser, who took sort of an anthropological approach to a lot of her food writing. And I loved it so much. And I think, oh, God, now if I could be one of those people, that's the holy grail.
Right.
That is the holy grail. But I just had no roadmap for how I would get there. So it wasn't like even a...
Welcome to the No Roadmap Club.
Yeah. It's a good club to be in.
All right. So now we need to get to the important... How do you herd sheep?
Well, this is funny. So the first farm I end up in Italy is in southern Tuscany. Huge farm, massive. God, I can't remember. A couple thousand hectares maybe. They had about 1,000 sheep. And I'd never truly worked on a farm before. I'd visited farms, but I'd never really worked on a farm. I didn't know anything. And it turned out that the people running this particular farm had more of a kind of social political project in mind, which was to create a commune, than that they truly had an understanding of agriculture. So eventually, through talking to people while I was there, started to realize that these people had no idea what they were doing, like zero. One of the most enlightening moments was this Australian and New Zealander came through because they do most of the sheep shearing around the world. Fun fact.
Yes, I knew that somehow.
So they came to shear the 1,000 sheep on this farm with their mobile shearing rig. And up until this point, I had watched the farmers kind of abuse the sheep, not in horrible ways, in just they were rough with them. You know, if they the biggest juxtaposition was on sheep shearing day when we were trying to get the sheep to file through this gate we'd set up to shear them. The Italian guys on this particular farm would like kick them and twist their tails to like get them to go forward. And that's, I thought, oh, that's how you do it, because that's all I'd seen at that point. And then I saw these guys from Australia and New Zealand who were so, so deeply trained in how to work with sheep. And they had this gentle touch. And it was this whole other way.
They made love to those sheep.
Yeah. And the sheep, like, it worked. It worked. And then I talked to them and they said, oh, man, you know, these guys don't know what they're doing. And then they said, look, this particular breed of sheep that we don't even know what it is. It's these sheep aren't good for their meat. They're not good for their wool and they're not good for their milk. We don't know why they have 1,000 of them.
That's awesome.
So I was like, okay.
Besides that, they're perfect sheep.
But yeah. I mean, the way we would herd those sheep is we would fan out a whole bunch of humans in a field and basically chase the sheep in you know, into the direction we wanted them to go. This was 2001. Fast forward 5 years, I returned to Italy to work on farms again and worked on a dairy in central Italy that was where we herded sheep. It was a smaller herd, 300 sheep, and these people knew what they were doing. I rode on horseback. I had sheep dogs. I would not push the sheep to where I wanted them to go. I would call them, and they would follow me.
Wow, that's impressive.
Just an entirely different way. So, you know, the answer to your question of how do you herd sheep is first you learn what you're doing, because you can do it the hard way, running like a madman through massive fields trying to corral these sheep. I mean, that's what the dogs are for. We didn't even have dogs on that first farm. We were the dogs. I mean, it was just a complete mess.
That's hilarious. So you come back from Europe, and then do you immediately start working in restaurant kitchens?
Not even. So I was very reluctant to, like, make this decision. So at that point, I worked at a not-for-profit organization because I was thinking maybe that's what I want to do. It was creating green space in the city, and it was specifically involved in building Brooklyn Bridge Park, which is now...
Right.
At the time, it was not really a real park, and now
sure.
It's a real park on the Brooklyn waterfront. And I worked there for a couple years. But again... It was the same thing, all my free time. And now I was starting to really go deep down the obsessive rabbit hole every night, some crazy new cooking project. I was cooking out of the French Laundry cookbook, which had fairly recently come out. And, I mean, those are ambitious
hard
recipes.
Yeah.
And I was doing them. You know, it was like that level of thing. And my sister was just like, dude, what are you doing? Clearly, you need to be cooking. You know, it's like I really needed that push.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, I was like, okay. So I went back to David Waltuck at Chanterelle. And I said, I'm thinking of maybe trying to do this for real. Can I stage here for real?
Staging is an internship, or technically, I guess, an externship. But it's when you work for free
right.
in a kitchen, just trying to soak up as much knowledge as you can till you get to the point where somebody might hire you, either that kitchen or another kitchen.
Exactly. And I was struggling with the question of whether to go to culinary school or not, but luckily through Chanterelle, I met a lot of great cooks there, and I was able to pick their brains. You know, the overarching message I got was from the ones who went to cooking school. They were like, I loved it, and I probably didn't need to go. And the ones who didn't go said, would have been nice to go, but here I am cooking
right.
alongside.
And I'm not $50,000 in debt.
Yeah, that's a huge consideration when you are entering a field where they're going to pay you close to minimum wage, if not minimum wage, starting out. So that was enough to kind of, okay, I'm going to go the apprenticeship route here.
Got it.
The staging route. So yeah, then I staged at Chanterelle much more. With a set schedule, and I'd go in several times a week, and on top of my full time job that I was working, and sweat equity.
Yes. Yeah. Sweat equity in your cooking career.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get, you have various restaurant jobs, right? And I know you worked at Beppe Cesare
Casella's, yeah.
I guess, Tuscan-influenced, if not, it's a Tuscan restaurant. It was a Tuscan restaurant.
Yeah, it was Tuscan.
Yeah. And then what made you turn to media?
So it sort of goes back to what I was saying before, where I would read these food writers who I loved, and I always thought, that's the job. That's the holy grail. That's the one. That's the thing. That's amazing. I can learn about any area that I want to learn about. I can write about it. I can communicate to other people because I like to do that, sometimes even when it's uninvited. teaching people things they maybe didn't ask to learn. But I still had no roadmap for how to get there. That was always my kind of secret ambition. I didn't articulate it. Like anyone who was close to me at the time, I don't think I ever articulated that to them because it was scary to even say, I want to do this thing because I had no idea.
Right. And this was pre-blog. So there was no way to do it without doing it for a publication.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I had no idea. I hadn't been a writer. I hadn't studied writing. What I did know was that having that professional experience seemed like something that would be really valuable. But I also knew from early on that my ambition was not to own my own restaurant, was not to work in restaurants for the rest of my life. I loved doing it for the time I did it. But it became increasingly clear as the years went on and as I went up the ladder in restaurants that I needed an exit strategy because
it wasn't the life you wanted to lead.
Yeah, no. It wasn't ultimately the life I wanted to lead. It was invaluable because obviously, like now I write about cooking and techniques and, you know, there are many, many food writers who are great who don't necessarily have that body of knowledge.
So. I don't know that I'm great, but I definitely don't have that body of knowledge.
I think there are big advantages to not knowing certain things because you can come at a story from the point of view, you can take the reader along on a ride of discovery.
Yes, that was always my thing.
I think that some of the best food writing that I've read, that's what happens, is you're along for the ride with somebody who's discovering something. And, of course, I discover things all the time and learn things all the time, but it's a little bit harder to cultivate that feeling of total awe and wonder when you're deep in the craft.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you get to your first writing job?
At this point, blogs were just starting to exist, but it was new. I didn't have clips, you know, writing samples, professional writing samples. I mean, the closest I could come to a writing sample was like my senior thesis in anthropology.
That's a really bad idea to send an editor senior thesis.
Yeah, you don't want to do
that. It's the fastest way not to get a writing assignment.
Absolutely. And I knew that. I knew that that was a terrible idea, so I needed some clips. But the catch 22 of that whole scenario is how do you get clips if you need clips?
Right.
So I thought, all right, I had this amazing experience several years ago working on farms in Italy. I'll go back and I'll work in Italy and France and in Spain and I'll start my own little blog about it and I'll write about my experiences and it'll get that muscle which had not been exercised for
absolutely.
A while.
Absolutely. It's all about exercising that muscle.
And it would give me something to show.
Yep.
Something to show that's not my senior thesis. And I blogged about it as I did it. And it was, you know, again, an amazing, life-changing experience. And I came back and I had to go back to working in restaurants initially. But I was at that point trying to pursue writing things. And I got an early assignment from Edible Brooklyn early on from Gabrielle Langholtz, the editor at the time.
No Gabrielle, well.
So that was great. That put my first real clip. I had a clip. And then I got an internship at Time Out New York.
And that turned into a gig.
And then
the rest is history.
There you go.
So you became the food editor at Time Out New York eventually.
I was the
restaurant critic? I can't remember.
I wrote reviews sometimes, but I was like the staff writer, basically.
Yeah. And Time Out New York was the gateway publication for many great young food writers because they didn't pay that well, but they gave a lot of people their first shot.
They sure did.
And especially in the pre-digital publishing world, because to your point, there's nothing but gatekeepers
right
around you. And it's like, how do you break through? I mean, I got my first assignment. It was actually writing a feature for Kool and the Gang for Rolling Stone, because I'd been a publicist at Warner Brothers Records. And then I got laid off, and John Prellis was at Rolling Stone, was the music editor. And I called him. I said, I need a writing assignment. He goes, can you write? I said, of course I can write. And that was you know, that, and people just can't believe that that was the way into writing. But I'd read magazines and newspapers obsessively about music. So I knew in my head the constructs that I had to follow. I'd never taken a journalism class. I was like you. I could have given them, you know, a college paper,
right,
but it worked out. I mean, I sort of, you know,
I think it's rare that you knew the constructs. I think it's not uncommon to see people aspiring to break into one form of writing or another. And even if they devour that content constantly, when they sit down to write, it's just like,
they can't internalize it. Yeah.
Yeah. Or understand this is what this publication needs. Yeah, or even even kind of get into the zone of the target.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's impressive that you nailed it on your...
Maybe it was luck. Who knows? How did you get from Time Out New York to the Gastronaut column and your gig at Food & Wine? Because that's a big leap.
It is, although Time Out, like, I mean, Time Out seeded a lot of people into the industry. And I think that was known, especially, you know, several years ago. If you went through the who's who of food media, at least in New York City, a lot of those people were Time Out alums.
Oh, sure. Adam Rappaport, who's now the editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit.
And Miley Carpenter, who's editor-in-chief of Food Network Magazine. Right. I mean, you go down the list, and there's some really serious names. And
you're absolutely.
Like, oh, wow, that one started it, Time Out. That one started it, Time Out.
Sure.
So I think that probably helped in terms of taking that next step. But you're right. I mean, Time Out was such a great experience for me because it was really like they trained me really fast in this, you know, what it means to
be a journalist.
Absolutely. But I wasn't cooking. And because Time Out is all about what to do when you go out in the city. So it's restaurant and bar coverage, chefs. It is not home cooking. Finally, there was a point where I was getting tired of chasing the trends. Not that I didn't have to do that at subsequent, like at Food & Wine.
I obviously
had to be very trend focused, but I wanted to change the direction that I was casting my light back to a big part of my skill set, which was cooking. So luckily, through an old colleague at Time Out, I got tipped off that Food & Wine was looking for a food editor. And a food editor needs some kind of real cooking training because you're not just editing articles, you're also editing recipes. And so I jumped at that real fast.
And you stayed for a few years, right?
Yeah. So I think more than 3 years, maybe 3.5 years.
And then you answered our ad with this letter that intrigued us. And then we were like, wow, he would leave Food & Wine for Serious Eats. And then you came in and you cooked. Like, we had all the finalists come in, and Kenji was texting me about every finalist. And you were the last one. You were the last one of the day. And everyone was fine, you know. We could, that person would be okay. And then, you know, I don't know if you know the story, but then Kenji would start texting me, wow, this guy can really cook, you know, and it was really funny. And then what was really unusual, you came after a full day of work.
Mm-hmm.
You cooked from like 7 to 8 or something like that.
Yeah.
And then you sat and talked with us about food and food media for like 2 hours.
Yeah.
And we were like, wow, this guy's really into it. We need him. And you were going into the deep end of the water. You were going into previously uncharted territory because, to your point, I didn't have a roadmap either, I can tell you that. Why did you decide to take that leap?
Yeah, you know, I felt like I was pushing into the future is more what it felt like. Food & Wine was such a great place to work. And actually, my 3.5 or however many years it was there was almost like nothing. Most people on the staff when I was there had been there 15, 20, 25, 30 years. People went to Food and Wine.
And stayed.
And they did not leave because it, I mean, it was a great job.
Right.
Great magazine. Great staff. I mean, really another place that was like a family. But you look around you and you see changes happening in an industry and you think, am I on the right ship here at a certain mm-hmm. point?
Yep.
So that's a part of it, was getting into the digital side, getting onto the internet side of publishing, which, you know, I'm not old, but I'm not young either. And it's important to be thoughtful about that from just a career building perspective. On top of that, I was a reader of Serious Eats for a long time, as we talked about when we met. And one of the things that always struck me about Serious Eats was that when I had some really weird, obscure question about something and I searched for it online, the one website that always seemed to come up if there was an answer out there was Serious Eats. That was the, you know, that was the one. And that had registered. Then Kenji's work had registered because I am an obsessive. And when I was at Food and Wine and I had this Gastronaut Files column, it was my chance to be kind of nerdy and get into the nitty-gritty of something. But I had to make that story fit on 2 to 3 pages. So there was a limit to how deep I could go. The real estate of the page dictated the thresholds of information that
sure.
I could pack into it. But when I was working on those stories, I would go so much deeper because I couldn't help myself. And they would say, Daniel, stop going down the rabbit hole. We know that you love going down the rabbit hole and we love you for it. And we think it's an amazing quality of yours, but we need you working on some other stories.
So are you saying that we had deeper rabbit holes?
You had way deeper rabbit holes. And I would read Kenji's stuff and I would think, man, this guy's going down the rabbit hole. I want to go down the rabbit hole. That's where I want to go. So when we talked and you were like, yeah, we're putting our money on quality, depth over quantity.
Right. And people thought I was insane.
And I said, man, that's music to my ears. That is exactly what I want to do. I'll put my chips down on that table. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Now, when you assess the food media landscape,
mm-hmm.
what do you see? And what advice would you have for somebody who wants to do what you do?
Any time of tremendous change and upheaval is an incredibly exciting time. It's a chance to rethink things, to do things in a new way. But it's also a time in which a lot of bodies get left scattered on the battlefield.
No lie. I used to say that Serious Eats was simultaneously terrifying and thrilling, often in the same day.
Yeah. I kind of feel like the industry is like that. I mean, the big publishers, you know, I never worked at Condé Nast, so I can't speak to it. But, you know, Food & Wine, when I was hired, was Amex Publishing. And then eventually, not too long before I left, was purchased by Time Inc. And, you know, that I won't lie, that was a stressful time and an uncertain time, and continues to be one as they go through changes. I mean, the stuff I hear at Time Inc., and I just get little snippets here and there, but it makes me, it's like Game of Thrones is what you know, it's
yeah.
like there are people who you think are just totally safe there, ruling some portion of the kingdom, and then suddenly they're
gone.
They've been dispatched.
Yes.
And it's just like, whoa, did that just happen?
Yeah.
And it keeps happening. I mean, you know, I'm not there. I don't know a ton of what happens. But from an outside, hearing little tidbits, whew, nerve-wracking. So it's industry-wide, that kind of that uncertainty and that stress.
People have to embrace that uncertainty.
It's just the reality, yeah, definitely. And I think, and why I really believe in what we do is that we just, and you know, this is there are certainly other examples of this in food media, but we just try to do the best work we can. And I have to think and hope that ultimately is the winning strategy, as opposed to chasing tirelessly
trends
and oh well, this latest thing has just been invented and now everyone has to be on, you know, some
right.
Of course you have to do all of the social
to acknowledge Snapchat and Instagram, but you can't let your life be ruled by
ruled,
them.
Yeah, yeah. Which, where's the horse and where's the cart, right?
Right.
That's sort of the thing. So, and, you know, we're all figuring it out together. And I don't think anyone has the answer. But it's exciting, too. I mean, there's so much stuff to try. There's so much stuff to do. And we have the luxury at Series Eats of indulging our passions. Of, you know, if there's some question I want to answer, some dish I want to explore, you guys let me do it.
Right. Yeah. So that's actually turned out to be the most exciting thing for me at Series Eats, like, is to identify people like you and Kenji and Stella and everybody who works at Series Eats and just sort of give them the runway to pursue their passions and watch them take flight. But getting back to this question of what should people do if they have this passion for food, I think what you're saying is just indulge it in various ways, whether it's on the side, whether it's a blog, whether it's working at a farmer's market. It's just throwing yourself into the food culture, not knowing that there is a certain path to go down.
Right. I think, yeah, in fact, there is no path. I think that one can be strategic, not sending in your senior thesis as a writing sample.
Right.
Trying to gain experience and knowledge in one way or another. Really thinking about what it means to be a writer, because you can't overlook, no matter how good a cook one may be or how knowledgeable about food, if you can't communicate those ideas in a way that's readable, and that's no small thing, that's a problem if you're aspiring to write about food. Hopefully, you're doing it because you love it.
Exactly. So you need the passion. I think you bring an incredible work ethic. You also bring writing chops. You know, I launched Series Eats. I'm the worst photographer that works at Series Eats by far. But I see now that people, you know, look at Kenji doing his own videos.
Right.
That people, they increasingly come through Serious Eats with multiple skills.
Yeah, that is, in this day and age, that is really important. The more you can do, the better your chances are.
Right. So let's talk about Brazilian martial arts.
Oh, yeah.
What's up with that, dude?
I have many passions. You know, one thing is, I like to cook, I like to eat, I like to think about food, but man, if that's all I did, I might have some health problems. You've seen me eat, Ed, you know.
Yes.
I don't hold back.
You don't hold back, dude.
So
it's very impressive.
So I need that outlet. So yeah, Capoeira, I kind of stumbled into it about 13 years ago, and it's just become a huge, huge part of my life. And it feeds a lot of different things for me. So I work now with food, but as you know, music is a passion of mine. I've been involved in music in one way or another all my life. Movement, trying to stay in shape, that is something I'm also passionate about and enjoy. And Capoeira has obviously the physical movements, and it has music. It's a martial art that's also a dance. It's a little bit hard to explain. People sometimes say, well, who wins? And it's like, yeah, it's kind of more complicated than that. Sort of my best analogy is that it's like physical real-time chess.
Wow.
It's a game of strategy that's played out in real time through your body.
Man.
It's also,
I've never heard you describe it that way. I don't know if I could do it.
Anyone can do it, but it's, you know, it's literally like learning a language, and it's a language with your body.
Yeah.
So it takes time and dedication, and nobody starts out good at it, like guaranteed. But that's okay. You just, you know, that's how you start at anything.
And you teach it now, right? Or you have?
Yeah, I mean, I'm part of a group, and we have a lead teacher. But I'll teach classes, particularly like if she's not available. You know, it depends. There have been times where I've taught more frequently. More recently, I haven't taught as much. As you know, I had wrist surgery several months ago.
Yes,
that I've been
recovering from. You know, this is a very, very strenuous and physically demanding martial art.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of part gymnastic. It's weird because it's unlike boxing or kickboxing or MMA or something where the objective is very clear. You want to beat the crap out of your opponent. Capoeira is not like that. And so it can be harder for people to understand because then they think, well, then it's not really a fight at all, right? Like if you're not trying to, like, because sometimes you throw kicks, but you're not intending to land them, which is unlike almost any other fighting form out there. But the mistake people make is to think that it's not also a fight because you can kick people and you do kick people and you get kicked and you throw people to the ground and you get thrown to the ground. It's just a little bit more complicated than that being your only objective. There's a lot of context and subtext, and there's so many different things to interpreting what's happening in any given moment, why you might have one interaction in what we would call a game that's more friendly and one that's much more aggressive and violent.
Wow.
It is very – the other analogy that you hear a lot is that it's like a conversation between two bodies where it can be a friendly conversation. You know, hey, how are you? So you put – one kick is the, hey, how are you? Then the other person responds with something else. Oh, I'm fine. How are you? Where it's more playful and convivial. But then you know how it is, like when you're talking to somebody and sometimes they just say that one thing.
It can turn dark in a second.
It can turn dark in a second. And next thing you know, you're in a full-blown argument. And that is like Capoeira also. So I don't know if
all
that
right.
helps.
This is good. So something that that a lot of people don't know unless you work at Serious Eats, you have a predilection, which makes sense given your passion for music, for making up songs while you cook.
Yeah, that's that. Yep.
So I would like you to just share one song that it could be one line.
They come and go as fleeting as.
So you mean you're like Eric Dolphy? Once you hear a note of music, it's over, and you can never hear that note again.
These little songs I make up are so silly, and they're not great works in any.
So you're not going to sing one for us.
Part of it's coming out of the. When I'm cooking, I'm engaged in this very repetitive kind of activity a lot of the times. I'm chopping and slicing, and my brain starts turning in other ways, and these other things start to emerge. And it's like, you know, I don't know. I could try to make something up, but it's not coming out of the same place.
Got
and
it.
It's like, you know, I'm chopping, chopping, chopping. I'm chopping some onions. I'm chopping, 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 chopping some onions. You know, maybe it's that. I don't know. It's like, and then someone is in the office, because it's also like my comfort level, right? So
right.
If I don't just do it all the time, but if I hit a point of comfort with people and my environment, I just start doing it sort of mindlessly. And then people look over and they go, what the hell is this guy doing?
I'm chopping, 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 chopping some onions.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes, I'll rhyme. Sometimes my rhymes fail. I'm by no means a good freestyler. Like it's just
right.
This thing that happens.
All right, that's good. All right, now it's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet. So
okay. What's
in your desert island fridge?
It's mostly going to be loaded with seafood, oysters and clams and lobsters and crabs and fish, squid, octopus. I mean, do I love a beautiful steak? Yeah, absolutely. But the seafood just.
You just want the world's biggest plat de mer.
Yeah.
Right?
Do you know, and I get this, well, it's my mom and my dad, actually, I get this. We just had celebrated my dad's birthday with a shit ton of oysters. But my mom had a story where she went into some place and they had an all-you-can-eat oyster deal. And it's a weird story because there were truckers who were there, and I don't quite know where you eat raw oysters with truckers. But she ate so many raw oysters that the waitress came up. She goes, you know, in all my years working in this restaurant, I ain't never seen anybody eat so many oysters as you, including all these truckers. This story makes no sense, but my mom used to tell it all the time.
That's hilarious.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Who's at your last supper, no family allowed?
You know, here's a funny thing. I have this weird recurring daydream in which I take the founding fathers on a tour of like modern American society. And I have no idea why I have this. Like it pops up like once every few months, and I like replay the scenarios in my head where I'm like sitting next to Thomas Jefferson on the plane, and I'm like, yeah, this is called an airplane. You know?
So you want Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington,
yeah,
and Ben
guys.
Franklin?
Those guys, yeah, precisely. Even though I'm not much of a history buff, I guess it's because we're in this country, and they're the ones who founded it. To be like, look around, look at this. And also to be like, oh, yeah, and you really messed up on that slavery thing. Like, you should be ashamed of yourself. And these people they're we ended that, and there's been fallout from it and unresolved problems ever since. And, you know, get them caught up to speed on how we think about things. So maybe that would be fun to sit around a table and kind of catch them up on what's happened since.
I like this. This is interesting. This is interesting.
But that's, you know, it's funny because that's not me receiving things from them. That's me telling them things. See, now you know I want to write about stuff. I want to tell people things.
So, and I know you have many, but give us a few of your guilty pleasures.
I am not a sweets person. But I am a dairy fiend. So if you give me that bowl of whipped cream, I don't care if you put sugar in it or not, I will eat a bowl of whipped cream.
I've seen you do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, oh man, creme anglaise. Oh my God. Like pastry cream, custard.
Straight up.
Ice cream. And it's not about the sugar. It's about the dairy fat. That's like just give me the dairy fat and all of it. I used to eat pats of butter when I was a kid.
Really? Straight up?
Yeah. I was like, I'd want to snack on them.
You snack on pats of butter. I love that. So this is a great question for you. What do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
I've hit some real lows, Ed.
Bring it on.
Some of my worst no food available stories. I once boiled, and this was in college, I boiled penne pasta, and then I tossed it with mustard, with yellow mustard. That's probably the most disgusting thing I've ever prepared for myself. It was so bad. I had no food. I was hungry. And I was like, I had dried pasta, and I had a bottle of mustard.
So there was no fat, there was no olive oil, there was no butter.
I don't think I had any, like, I didn't have anything. I mean, that's...
You truly had nothing in the house to eat.
I used what I had, but I'm capable of that. Like, I try to stock sardines, tins of sardines, which I'll scarf down when I'm desperate, and that's a step up from the mustard pasta for sure. I'm weird, though, because I'm also like a camel. Like, I stuff my face, but then I can go very long stretches without eating. Usually, it's like I hit a point where I realize that I'm getting lightheaded, and then it's like, oh, God, I got to eat something.
You're a camel. I like that. Who would you love to have a one-on-one lunch with?
When I was a kid, I was the world's biggest Roald Dahl fan. I have a collection of Roald Dahl books that is, like, museum-worthy.
Really?
Not even kidding. Not that I am kidding.
Right. They're not first editions, but I get it.
No, they are first editions.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm – yeah. I have the first edition, near mint condition dust jacket of The Gremlins, the first book he ever wrote.
Wow. You're serious.
Oh, yeah. No joke.
So you would like to break bread with Roald Dahl.
I think so. It's a little scary, though, because it's like this is a person who informed my entire childhood – everything about how his mind worked in the books he created for children and for adults was so perfect for me. I loved just his irreverence and his zaniness and his kind of the dark humor. When I was five, we bought the Twits for a friend of mine, and his parents rejected it. They gave it back. They said, we can't let our son read this because it's like my favorite book. That was like a truly one of my childhood heroes. So I guess if I had to pick someone, it would be like Roald Dahl. But then it's scary too, because maybe I don't want to meet Roald Dahl. Maybe
it'll be disappointing.
Yeah, like maybe they just like.
I think you got to take that risk.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Daniel Gritzer, for sharing your special sauce with us. Check out Daniel's extraordinary columns on Serious Eats. And if you can think of a name for it, let us know, right? Because you and I are always trying to come up with a name for your column.
Right, we got the Food Lab, and we've got Brave Tart, and
right.
then I'm like...
But I think maybe the Camel.
Camel. How to starve yourself between huge bouts of overeating.
So, and we're going to have Daniel back on to answer your questions about holiday cooking on some future call special sauce episodes. So we'll keep you posted about when you can send in questions for him. So thank you, Daniel. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Ed.
And so long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.